Blog Talk Radio. The theme today, Spies, Crimes, and Resistance. And then we have Alex Speaks to the Community. And we will close out with announcements and supporting MPH Radio. That's our order for today. Like always, we encourage you to participate by calling in at 818-337-0016. MPH Radio, we welcome you on April the 1st, 2023. Let's get started with our program, which will start out with this particular issue. And this issue is, what is freedom? Freedom is something often talked about, fought over. Millions of people have died over it. Millions of people are still dying over this concept. And I think it would be who anyone, if you're going to die over such a concept, you should know what it is and what you're striving for. So in terms of giving you some concepts of how other people have interpreted this concept of what is freedom, I'm going to put it to you in terms of a question today. And the question is, if you had the power to do, are you free? If you had the power to do, are you free? Think about that. That's our question today in terms of what is freedom. If you have the power to do, are you free? He said power is defined as the ability to do. So if you have the ability to do, does that make you free? Think about that. You can share your thoughts with us later on during this program. Right now, get your pen and paper out, like always. We want to share with you some history as relates to our people's contribution to humanity. And by doing that, we can bring in our member, our supporter, Sister Susie, and she will share with you some MPH Black Minute Facts. Susie, we'd like to welcome you to MPH Radio. What minute facts do you have for us this week as entails from the 26th of March to April the 1st? Welcome, Susie, to MPH Radio.
Good evening. For today's Mini Black Facts, we have Shirley Graham, divorce author and Pan-Africanist, died in 1977. Also on the 28th, we had W.C. Handy, one of the most important figures in the 20th century, U.S. popular music history, died. On the 30th, in 1870, the 15th Amendment granting African men in the U.S. the right to vote is formally adopted into the U.S. Constitution. On the 31st, we had Provisional Government of Republic of New Africa, the RNA, founded in Detroit, Michigan in 1968, and last ending on April 1st, we had Gil Scott-Heron, which was born in 1949. I've just given you some Black Mini Facts from March the 27th through April the 1st, 2023.
Thank you, Susan, for your Black Mini Facts. And today is the 1st, and this was the day that Brother Gil was born. He was a revolutionary musician, and our heads goes out to him as a cultural artist and the role that he has played to try to elevate our communities and people. So in memory, Brother Gail, we salute to you. Job well done. Now what we're going to do is we're going to open up with a special segment we're going to be doing from time to time on MPH Radio. And after you hear the segment, we're going to open our phone lines up. We'd like to have your response to this particular segment, which is dealing with the Black Caucus Support Police Militarization. The Black Caucus Support Police Militarization. You know, in our communities, we are trying to find ways of how to lower the temperature in our community as relates to the oppression that our people are facing from police brutality. There have been many calls from our communities and various other communities that have been victimized by the police departments as relates to state-sponsored terrorism. And we want to know, what is the Black Caucus doing? Listen to this piece, and when we come back, we'd like to have some discussion on it.
This is the Real News Network. I'm Sharmini Peres coming to you from Baltimore. Welcome to the Glenn Ford Report on the Real News Network. Glenn is the executive editor of the Black Agenda Report and the regular commentator on the Real News Network. Glenn, in a report recently on the Black Agenda Report, you wrote that 80% of the members of the Congressional Black Caucus refused to defund Pentagon's militarization of local police departments, also known as the Grayson Amendment. That is shocking news given that the police brutality of the black community in this country, and I'm wondering if you have more to say on that.
Well, actually, it was 27 who voted against Alan Grayson's measure that would have forced the Pentagon to stop sending all these weapons and military gear to local police department. 27 voted against the amendment. 5 abstained, which is just as good as voting against it. And that makes 32 out of only 40 caucus voting, full voting members. Now, that's 4 out of 5 of the black caucus voted to continue the Pentagon's massive infusions of guns and tanks and other military gear into local police departments. But that's only one of the complaints that's being voiced by a group, a coalition in Washington that's planning to hold a shame on the Congressional Black Caucus rally on September 24th. September 24th is the first day of the Congressional Black Caucus's annual legislative conference and gala. That's the time of the year that every year the caucus draws thousands of people all dressed to the nines for a bunch of workshops and stuff, but mainly for their gala dinner and lots of music and entertainment and festivities and basically about 3 or 4 days of the caucus patting itself on the back for all the good deeds it's done, or maybe just for being here. This year, finally, a group of activists in D.C. Are putting their 2 cents in and saying, no, we don't appreciate a bit what you've been doing. And so they're focusing on the caucus's vote back in July, just 3 days after the Israelis began bombing Gaza. A vote to join with the rest of the House unanimously in giving a blank check to Israel. The organizers of that protest are also outraged at the fact that most members of the Congressional Black Caucus seem ready to go along with corporate America and turn the internet over to the corporations to destroy internet neutrality. The fact of the matter is that since 2005, the Congressional Black Caucus has been more aligned with the telecoms, the big corporations that want to control the internet and all of our communications. They've been more aligned with these corporations than the Democratic Caucus as a whole. And this is ongoing. This has been for the last 9 years. And since the organizers planned to do this shame on the Congressional Black Caucus rally, of course, Ferguson happened. And so they're going to call attention to the fact that 4 out of 5 of the Congressional Black Caucus members voted to continue the militarization of the police. And now almost all of them, in fact, are pretending like, oh, well, they were against militarization all along. They weren't. 4 out of 5 were for it.
What justification is there for such a move, given, particularly given Ferguson now? Is there an attempt to reverse the decision? Is there any consciousness post-Ferguson?
Actually, Hank Johnson, who voted for the amendment after Ferguson happened, then he announced plans to reintroduce the amendment. I guess the idea is that now that the caucus has been caught on the wrong side in the glare of publicity, maybe they'll change their votes. What really happened back in June is the caucus thought it was voting in the dark, that nobody was looking. And in fact, very few people are looking. There's very, very little independent black media that is watching every day the goings on Capitol Hill. And so, yeah, they were voting in the dark. This rally on September 24th, which will be right in front of the Washington Convention Center where the caucus is holding all of its entertainment and other festivities, well, that may set them back a little bit with this very public demand for accountability. And that's what people are talking about. The caucus needs to be accountable. And if it were accountable to black sentiment, then it could still use in good faith its slogan, which is we are the conscience of the Congress. But the caucus has not been the conscience of the Congress. It has not been a dependable, progressive body for a very, very long time.
Glenn, is this an effort to raise funds for the caucus? What is there to celebrate?
Oh, it is their big fundraiser, and all you have to do is go there and you will see where the funds come from. The corporations are, certainly well represented. The CBC has become one of the biggest fundraising caucuses in the Congress. It is the go-to place to buy influence, not in the black community, but among its representatives on Capitol Hill. And shaming is, in fact, what's important here in this exercise that's going on, that will be going on the 24th. Shaming is a very, very important tool for people, especially people who don't have power. The corporations have power in this country, and poor folks and black folks don't have much more than the ability to shame those who purport to represent them by saying loud and clear, you don't represent us. And it's more than just the emotional impact of shaming. It's not just attempting to get wayward elements of the caucus to see the light or to be embarrassed. When groups say, as the rally is trying to say, that these people do not represent us, they in fact devalue, they lessen, diminish the value of the caucus to the corporations. And that applies also to individual politicians and so-called leaders. The corporations, people with power, go out and buy the influence of so-called black leaders because they think it's worth something, because they think it translates into assent on the part of the black masses to what the corporations are doing. But when people rise up and say, no, we don't support that organization, we don't support that politician, we don't support that caucus, then the value of those individuals and organizations that offer themselves as agents for power is diminished. So it has real impact beyond emotional, beyond just an appeal to the reason and decency of the politician or the so-called black leader.
Glenn, is there any members of the black caucus that is upholding the, you know, values and consciousness of the black community here?
Well, there have been some seminal votes, and I think the vote on militarization of local police forces was one of them, in which you only had seven who voted correctly. Those included John Conyers and Barbara Lee and Congresswoman Waters and Hank Johnson and about three others. But with the vote on Israel, it was unanimous. Just like the whole House voted in favor of giving Israel a blank check, all of the caucus went along and without even one abstention. I would say off the top of my head that there's no more than seven or eight Congressional Black Caucus members who are worth a damn, even sometimes. Sometimes none of them are worth a damn.
Glenn, thank you so much for joining us again on the Real News Network.
Thank you.
If you had a choice of colors, Which one would you choose, my brother? If there was no day or night, which would you prefer to be right? How long have you hated your white teacher? Who told you you love your black preacher? Do you respect your brother's woman friend and share with black folks not of kin? People must prove to the people
a better day is coming
for you and for me. With just a little bit more education
and love for our nation
would make a better society. Now some of us would rather cuss and make a fuss than to bring about a little trust. But we shall overcome, I believe, someday, if you'll only listen to what I have to say.
And how long have you held your white teacher?
Who told you you love your black preacher? Can you respect your brother's woman friend and share with black folks not of kin? I say now people must prove to the people
a better day is coming
for you and for me. With just a little bit more education
and love for our nation,
would make a better society. And if you had a choice of colors, which one would you choose, my brothers? If there was no day or night, which would you prefer to be right? And if you had a choice of colors, which one would you choose, my brothers? If there was no day or night, which would you prefer to be right? If you had a...
Welcome back to MPH Radio. That's right. If you had a choice of color, which one would you choose? Prior before our break, we played a clipping via news as Glenn Ford from Black Agenda Report was interviewed, and he was speaking to the subject of the Black Caucus Support Police Militarization. Our phone line is open at 818-337-0016. If you would like to share your thoughts on this particular issue in terms of answering the question for the day, is what's up with that? What's up with the Black Caucus supporting this whole question on the militarization of the local police here, as well as giving the militarization of and funding to the State of Israel that has a history of genocide not only Palestinian people, but also African people? What is it about allowing them to have a blank check when they can't bring a half a check to any of their communities? So we want to fill in this whole question, this missing pages, as relates to the performance and the history of the Black Caucus when it comes to African community interests. At this point in time, if you'd like to speak to this issue, please hit 1, and we'll acknowledge your last 4 numbers. But right now, we can go to our co-host. We'd like to get his response first. Brother Alex, what's up with that?
Well, hello, Mr. Lee. I appreciate being here today, and I enjoyed the clip that you just played, and I thank Susie for giving us that good rendition of history again, that facts that we need to, you know, remember. There are so many things on so many dates that we have done. But Mr. Ford's clip that you played, I would just want to direct back to that for a moment. He was an outstanding journalist and from the Maryland, D.C. area. And he, you know, served in Vietnam as a veteran and a member of various organizations and did a lot of good, you know, for the community. And as a journalist and uncovering and talking to people, you sort of get your, a feel of what candidates say and will do. Because on the campaign trail, there was a lot of promises made. And I myself have joined countless voter organizations and spoke at rallies and did different things trying to get people elected. And then I wonder, will they carry through? We have to hold people accountable, yes, from what they say from the campaign speech till the moment they serve in Congress. A lot of them have their own agenda before they get there. Then some of them formulate an agenda afterwards. They join cliques or gangs or whatever we want to call them, but they socialize within each other, and they begin to find things that the common man sometimes out here is ignored by. And one of those things is power and wealth. When you start offering people bribes and different things to have things come your way or go your way as far as a community is concerned or a state is concerned and a country is concerned. So we in good faith try to elect people in good honor, that they're going to carry out the wishes of the people, to support the people, because that's what the country is about. You have no country without the people. But often the people are forgotten, and that is the biggest reason why Dr. King came of prominence, because people were forgotten. Black Caucus, yes, a lot of members over time have turned their backs on their own community and have made votes that are more than just questionable. You know, how in the world could you do this? How in the world could you vote this way? But money and power becomes a problem. And then the reelection to continue that power until they basically die in office. So we have to be more careful with our votes and who we elect, listen to them much more closely. And then, yes, bring them to shame. Because it's now become a business of who's who, as who's been elected and how long they can stay in power. So we have to shame them and bring them back to reality. This is what we voted you in for, and we will not vote for you next time. But I can't wait to hear from the other responses here because, like I said, I write to members of Congress, try and deal with them on a one-on-one basis as a constituent. And like I said, it is a tough battle. It is a very tough battle. So I'll turn it back to you.
Thank you, Alex. We'll go to our member and supporter, Susie. And we'd like to have her thoughts on this question of police, Black Caucus support, police militarization on a local level, as well as when it comes to the state of Israel, giving them a blank check to take as much money as they want, but yet in their own communities, they can deliver a heavy check. The question is, what is going on? What's up with that? Susan, your response.
Okay. The only thing I can say, like Mr. Joyner said, basically we're going to have to hold people accountable. The thing of it is, I think as a whole, we get complacent and we're really not concerned about a lot of things that involves us. And unless we get out, we got to get out the word more about organizations, because when I think about it, I haven't heard anything about the Black Caucus in years. But according to the tape that was played, they're apparently doing a lot of work. So we as a whole, we got to really start looking back at these organizations and everything and see if they are really working for the benefit of us. But everything just gets quiet and the news media doesn't cover it. So basically, as a whole, most of us really don't think much of a lot of the other older organizations. We're mainly looking to these newer organizations that are forming that has more of a fight than the old organizations like the Black Caucus in on their behalf. And basically, that's all I have to say.
Thank you, Susie, and to my listening audience today, we're going to go to you right now. We want to know, what are they doing? What is Black Caucus doing by lending their support to militarizing local police forces? Give them a blank check to the State of Israel. We'd like to hear your thoughts. We'd like for you to write in this missing pages of history. So we'll go to our caller. Caller, we'll come to you at 6029. Call your thoughts.
You know, I think we have to study the fundamentals. I think one of the problems in terms of, you know, leadership in the African community is that when we elect those people, we're essentially electing people who really believe in the system. Now, the question is this: if you really believe in the system, you're voted into power to represent that system. Do you really honestly think that they're going to vote in terms of policies that oppose that system? This is a fundamental problem that we have. So we expect people who essentially endorse the system to get into positions of power and then to fight that system. It simply doesn't happen that way. The bottom line is the masses of people in society don't become enlightened, at least politically enlightened, and begin to understand, you know, how the system operates, we're not in a position to actually, assign that kind of power to people who really are concerned with our interests. Right now, we have a situation where essentially those individuals who have visibility, those people who the system legitimizes, are the people that we tend to give legitimacy to. We end up putting them into positions of power simply because of the question of legitimacy. The problem is that those individuals who truly represent the interests of the people will never get in power because essentially the masses of people will reject the message of anyone who says, you know, elect me, I'm going to fight this system. They're not going to vote for that individual. So this is a fundamental problem that we're having. And just in terms of the monetary corruption, you know, one of the things, you know, if you see yourself as an American, as opposed to the African born in America, then the bottom line is you got to agree that this focus on material gain is a prime motivator for you. If your prime motivator is to make some money, then why on earth would you support or introduce policies that has potential on negating your opportunity to make money? As long as these politicians, these black politicians play ball, that's money to be had. So in the clip, the narrator talked about the fact they have these lavish parties which are supported by corporations. Of course, that money is going to continue to flow as long as these black representatives continue to play ball. I think as in terms of the masses of people, we have become more enlightened. But unfortunately, the masses of people, too, have incorporated this view that somehow that this war that's being waged against African people is a war that doesn't exist. As long as we fail to understand, you know, that is a war waged against us, and you can look at it politically, socially, economically. It doesn't matter what parameter you use to measure this war. There is a war being measured against African people. And if we don't fundamentally understand that, then we're not in a position to put people in positions of power who are going to fight for the interests of African people. Now, when you talk about, you know, this 1022 program, where they consistently, and this, matter of fact, this discussion around, you know, sending military weaponry to police has been in discussion ever since Obama was in office. So now, when you talk about a situation where you're sending high-power weaponry to the police to essentially terrorize a community, well, of course, the weaponry itself makes it much, much easier in terms of terrorizing that community. It's not like the politicians don't understand that. And when you talk about the disproportionate amount of upheaval that's inflicted on the African community in terms of police brutality, Clearly, anyone who supports better weaponry, more weaponry more efficient in terms of the capacity to kill, anyone who supports such a measure is in my mind, is with those endorsements are tantamount to genocide against African people, because that's nowhere under the sun you can give essentially a military force, the police, those kind of arms, that kind of weaponry, who has a history in terms of brutalizing people, which goes back to the history of slavery. To give those people that kind of weaponry and not think that that's going to be used to decimate or to kill increasing numbers of African people. And this is the irony. But again, it is coming upon the mass of people to become enlightened, politically enlightened, to understand, you know, what this is all about. Until we come to fundamentally understand that we're at war, you know, we're not going to make the strategic moves that we need to make in terms of moving forward in society. My biggest fear, as the society moves rightward, increasingly, very, very fast pace, my biggest fear is that, you know, when you think about the speed at which the right wing, the far right, has been organized in society. And when I talk about far right, I'm not talking about the Yahoos, the rubes, you know, then rule America. I'm talking about, you know, your mainstream politicians, billionaires, you know, who endorse a fascist agenda. When you think about that kind of growing influence in the society, it seems to me that African people don't have other choice but in terms of recognizing what the reality is and to organize around that reality. And more importantly, I think one of the things we have to do in terms of for our future, we have to begin educating our children. You know, our children are dropping out of school disproportionately. We don't seem to get it. We don't understand there's a system in place that reinforces, encourages this kind of thing. We don't understand that. So until we understand the fundamental mechanics of the society, then we continue to play ball with the system that's diametrically opposed to African survival. So it seems to me, you know, the enlightenment of the masses of people is key in terms of getting the correct kind of leadership and positions of power to advocate on behalf, you know, of African people.
Carl, thank you for your comments. I want you to stay put because you said something really interesting as it relates to one being a representative of a community versus one representing the interest of an establishment or institution. And we can come back with that a little later on as we talk about this case dealing with Judge Clement, who recently ruled against Mumu Abu-Jamal. But we're going to talk about that after we finish this subject matter. But you stay put in to my next caller. You're going to bring in caller 7236. Caller 7236, welcome to MPH Radio. Your thoughts on militarizing the local police force and the support that they have been receiving from the Black Caucus.
I think the militarization of the police force, thank you so much for allowing me to speak, and thank you for this great show, and to Sister Susie, Brother Alex, and to you, Brother Africa, Brother Lee. The militarization of the police is a buildup of what's to come. We see that Social Security is expected to fail in about 2033. And we see that the war on the poor is still going on. And we see how comfortable as a community we've come with killing each other and the police killing us. Already this year, there have been 139 mass shootings in the United States. So I see this militarization of the police as a buildup to the future and how they will handle the citizens. And when you live in a when there's authoritarianism, as we saw with Donald Trump, as we see in other countries around the world, like we saw in Brazil with Bolsonaro, we see in India and Turkey, other countries, you see that the first thing these people want to do is pull out the military. When there was a protest in Lafayette Square in Washington, D.C., Donald Trump's first idea was to pull out the troops. His second idea was to to have the demonstrators moved out of Lafayette Square with the National Guard so that he could do a camera view, have photos taken of himself at St. John's holding a Bible upside down. So, you know, the militarization of the police is intended for greater control over the civilian population. And this weaponry that looks around corners, face recognition, in many communities, that's already in use. So I see it as a danger to the community. And I think that we have a Congress that's generally uninformed, misinformed, and uneducated. And the Black Caucus seems to be following suit, not suggesting that they're as bad as the Marjorie Taylor Greens and others, but they are following the suit of the Congress, following suit, you know, trying to line up. And I think it's important, and this will be quite a new thing to see a demonstration on at the site of the annual convention of the Black Caucus. And it's really that caucus is really for the affluent and the elite, because it is the major fundraiser for the Congressional Black Caucus. And it has grown weak over the years. It doesn't have a planned agenda of its own. So it's open to anyone else, anything that comes up, they just go along with it. They haven't really sat down and analyzed, for example, the Israeli-Palestinian problem. They haven't really looked at policing in America or even sponsored a study on it to make an educated decision. So militarization of the police is for greater control over the masses. And you see the special police are now able to be armed and have police duties when they're at work. You see, and all they do is go to shooting ranges once a year and practice, get a certificate, and they're walking around armed in the community. So you see increased police forces. You see the park police. You see the executive police, you see the metropolitan police. There'll be so many different police forces and individual communities depending on where you live. And this militarization is getting us ready. When there are less resources, then you're not able to provide for the masses, what comes next? And that's the real question. And I think that militarization of the police is part of the answer of what comes next.
Thank you, Carla. We'll keep you, put you on hold. And let's go to our next caller. Caller 4298. 4298, your thoughts on the militarization of the local police. Why the Pentagon is so unnecessary to militarize the local police? What messages are they sending to the citizens of this so-called country? Carla, your thoughts on it, 4298.
Yeah, well, the domestication of the militarization of the police is consistent with the foreign policy and the domestic policy being the same policy, which is capitalism, imperialism, racism, and Zionism. And the military of the police means that we are able to more dominate the community and put down any resistance, because there's going to be spontaneous resistance as capitalism crumbles and the police are necessary to squash the resistance. Well, I'll leave it right there. Thank you.
Thank you, Carla. To the listening audience, as we talk about this issue of militarizing the local police force and looking at the relationship between the policies domestically and internationally and how they all support each other in terms of militarizing this global world to stay in power, there was a recent decision that took place, I believe, yesterday as it relates to Mumia Abu-Jamal. And sort of related to this discussion, particularly this question of resistance. You know, over 40 years more, people have been resisting the injustice that has inflicted Brother Mumia by being falsely, you know, in prison, has been accused of killing a particular police cop. Now, that was an African judge in Philadelphia. She made a real interesting decision, and I would like for y'all to weigh in on, you know, what kind of signal does this behavior exhibit when you tell people that it's important to know facts and get the truth, but then when the truth is presented to you, you are acting in a way that's being very, very strange and definitely a way that seems to be against the interests of justice in your community. I read a statement just recently came out, and this statement came from, we got this released this morning from the Million Woman March as relates to the decision that took place yesterday on Mumia case. It says that a special report on this yet another civil constitutional and human rights violation, Mumia Abu-Jamal, and where do we go from here? The title of this article is, Judge Clemens rules against admitting any new evidence illegally withheld by the prosecution. This article written on the 31st by Don Real. It states that Friday, March the 31st, 2023, Judge Clemens of the Court of Commerce plea for Philadelphia had just ruled today against Mumia Abu-Jamal. Despite the prosecution illegally hiding countless boxes of evidence from Mumia Abu-Jamal and his for over 40 years, that the prosecution still hasn't finished turning it over. Judge Clemens has said that none of the evidence matter because Mumia would have been convicted anyway. This incredible, preposterous ruling needs to be started again. Judge Clemens has ruled that no matter what evidence the prosecution illegally would have and still has not turned over, it will not prove Mumia Abu-Jamal is anything except guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. What is up with this? Brother Alex, your response.
And Mr. Lee, I guess it proves again that every judge maybe don't belong on the bench. We have in this society a lot of things that we have to look at first because judges sometimes give their own independent assay of what's going on in their courthouses, what information is to be taken in, what information is not to be presented. When they go to chambers and discuss something, and throw things out or add things that are included is usually a judge's decision. Those decisions are supposed to be countered by the law, what says in the statute of the state. Well, the state usually wants to remove a lot of evidence on the party of the guilty. And the reason why, because it brings up reasonable doubt in any case. So be successful in prosecutions, maybe sometimes you need as less evidence as possible. And especially it seems like in the African-American community where many men have went to jail for many years and are now being exonerated because of evidence not introduced. Now, judge withholding some of it and some of it being withheld by the police, some of it being withheld by prosecution. So it seems like it's a uniform effort to make sure that certain evidence doesn't get in the court to convict people of certain crimes that they want them convicted. Well, when you're relying on a system that also brings in incompetent lawyers or lawyers that take cases from the public defender's department, you don't have the best legal advice as your trial moves forward. This judge has made an absurd suggestion. Does it reflect reality? I've never seen, I've read cases over and over again with the Innocent Projects. So I go back on that and say, no, I've seen some wild things that should not have been done in court cases. So I have to really go back because there are many cases, yes, I've reviewed now, going back over and thinking that maybe this is the norm for certain judges that want to stay within the system of whatever justice they're trying to uphold or being seen in the public eye, or maybe they have their own sponsors or someone that they have to raise money for to stay in elected office or whatever. But it all goes back to the same system of conviction and who you're convicting. So when we're looking at who's being convicted, who's being put on trial, it seems like justice is just not there for African Americans. And I think her decisions were, in this case, definitely were deplorable. And I would like to look at other cases just to see how she's ruled. But then again, I go back to her background and I checked a little bit just to, you know, see what may have made her influence this, because sometimes spouses influence you, sometimes business partners influence you, sometimes state senators or governors or whatever. Anybody may influence judges at certain levels, so we don't know. But it's just we need to discuss this more because this is ridiculous. This is a man's life who's been there for many years, and if there's evidence to exonerate him, it needs to come forward. And when you're talking about you have 200 boxes of evidence, somebody needs to go through that and just see what may be there to overturn this case. And I turn the mic back to you.
Thank you, Brother Alex. Caller 6029, is this a case where power will concede onto power? It's not what you know, it's who you know. Power will only concede to power. What lessons can we learn from this case? How does it reflect this institution when you're saying it's an institution based on freedom, justice, and equality? Your thoughts on this case and this ruling, caller 6029.
Well, let us deal with some reality. We understand that this judge's position is to represent the state. Her thing is to represent the interests of the state. Even though theoretically we talk about law, you know, being essentially neutral, the bottom line is that these institutions are impacted not only by history, not only by legal precedent, but also by in terms of the philosophy of the day. One of the things that's very interesting about this case is that this judge, Lucretia, she stated that there are tons of boxes with information that would exculpate or exonerate Mumia Abdul-Jabbar. So she's aware that information exists. So probably in order for her to be aware that it exists, she must have had at some point perused or looked through these files. But yet she concludes that even though the information to exonerate Mumia Abdul-Jabbar exists, he would be found guilty anyway. Now, in terms of legal precedent, just in terms of legal statute, what the hell does that mean? What the hell does that mean? He would have been convicted anyway. It makes no sense. It's nonsensical. So clearly, the interest that she represented, aside from her own, is the interest of the state. They understand that a very serious wrong has been committed against Mumia Abdul-Jabbar. They understand that. Not only do they understand that, but if they were to acknowledge that, one, it would reflect on just how corrupt the system is. And secondly, in terms of monetary compensation, they would have to pay Mumia Abdul-Jabbar a tremendous amount of money. And given the overall decline of the economy as capitalism declines, they are not in a position in terms of giving out money in terms of to address legal wrongs. So there are a lot of sentences for these people to play ball and to ensure that Mumia Abu-Jamal stays in prison. And hopefully, and am I assuming that they are hoping that he would die in prison and this would just all go away. But my own inclination is that it won't go away. I mean, he's got a strong base. And even if he's transitioned in prison, then the struggle will continue in terms of just revealing just how corrupt, how inept this system really is. I think also, you know, when we talk about in terms of the role of power, one of the things we this whole question in terms of status, I think, is something that we have to come to grips with. You know, to the extent, you know, status is derived from acquiescing to the system, we have to reject such conditioning. We have to at some point begin to see ourselves as free and liberated beings. And that is a very individual kind of thing. But I think until we get to the point where we start seeing ourselves as free and liberated, we continue to see ourselves in the context of, you know, how others see us. And in the context of a capitalist America, if you don't serve the interests of the system, then, of course, the visibility or the kind of a status that you want to achieve is simply not available. So there's some powerful temptation to play along with the rules of the game as the system defines them to achieve status and recognition. I think fundamentally, if we don't reject that, we're going to have more Lucretias, you know, on these benches or doing things that are beyond incomprehensible. I mean, the bottom line is that when I go back to this whole question in terms of when she says, you know, he's guilty anyway. What the hell? I mean, he's guilty anyway. I mean, when you stop and think about it, that's infuriating. I mean, he's guilty anyway. That presupposes that there are no legal standards. That presupposes you that the rule of law doesn't exist. That presupposes, you know, that the bias exhibited against Abu-Jamal is right and justifiable under law. And if you stop and think about that, then if all that is true, then in essence, then what we're saying, you know, this question in terms of justice, in reality, is no justice. And if that is the situation, then do we really think in terms of just, you know, equality and equity in society when it comes to the law, do you really think it's going to be applied equitably if, in fact, no law really exists? And I know this long discussion around the question in terms of, when it comes to the Constitution, around the question of originalism, in terms of conservative position is that, you know, according to the Constitution, as originally crafted, then, you know, the power of the few, the power of the oligarchs, serene supreme. And so everything else follows from that. So those people in positions of power do whatever they want to do, and the consequences for the masses of people is really unimportant, because what is important is that the power be exercised by the oligarchy. Now, if that's what it's all about, if it's all about empowerment of the oligarchy, and the oligarchy doing whatever the hell they want to do, then when we talk about law in terms of the oligarchy's interpretation of law, of course they're going to do what they got to do in terms of maintaining power. And if that maintaining power means systematically imposing injustices on the citizens, then that's precisely what it's going to do. And until we come to realization and understand that as African people in this society, you know, that we have a fundamental right to exist. And aside from that, we have to fundamentally fight for that. I mean, make no mistake about it. If we think somehow that simple discourse or talking to powers that be is going to be sufficient in terms of bringing about a change in terms of the mentality of these people who are positions of power, then we're sadly deluded. We have to take a stand. We have to understand, you know, that we have a right to exist, and we have to fight for that right to exist. And this kind of outrage committed against Mumia Abu-Jamal, if any right-thinking African in society has a sense of credibility, sense of what is right and what is wrong, they have to be outraged in terms of this. But more importantly, they have to understand the implications. If they can do that to Abu-Jamal, they can pick your eye up and do it the same thing to us. So that's an implicit threat in terms of how the laws are interpreted in society. And African people, by the way, wake the hell up and understand this is the bottom line. This is the reality. They have all this stuff about being a citizen, or they have all this justification and rationalization in terms of why these legal rulings come down. There's no justification for it. Either you're going to have justice or you don't have justice. Clearly, in the American society and the capitalist rubric of capitalism, clearly there is no justice. And we have to fundamentally understand the reality, and we have to fight in order to exist in the society. And I close with that.
We hear you, brother man. You in the seat, and you give us some heat. So let's go to our next caller. Caller 4298. 4298. Your thoughts.
Thank you. Thank you. This situation we're faced with capitalism, you know, we've got to organize. We got to form political parties, organizations, and join organizations that are fighting for the liberation of our people. This is the true way out of this situation. Consciousness put into organization and conscious resistance, with not only a defense but into an offense of pro democracy, pro socialist, communist values. Donald Trump is threatening the democracy with how we prosecute him, and it's the same all over. It's a question of democracy and a question of whether there's going to be rule of law or not, and that's the real issue. How we're going to function as human beings and human relations, how we're going to relate to each other, whether it's going to be equality and justice or whether it's going to be some kind of elitist society who are above the law. And that's the real issue, whether we're going to be above the law or not. Thank you.
Thank you, Carlo. You said rule of law? What is that? Carlo, 7236, 7236. What is rule of law? Your thoughts, Carlo.
Well, there seems to be a double standard with rule of law. It's who can afford private counsel and who can afford counsel. What I find interesting about Mumah Abu-Jamal is that he was a journalist when he was, and he was working on a story. He's a former Black Panther, and he's been convicted. And now Julian Assange has been convicted for a video he made called Collateral Damage. It seems that those two persons should be supported simultaneously, but it shows the great racial divide in our country that Abu-Jamal, the folks that are supporting Julian Assange, are talking about free press. But couldn't we also draw the parallel with Abu-Jamal that since he was there doing a story, it's my understanding that he was, he's not being supported as a member of the press. He's not being supported as a nationalist, you know, a person standing up for African-American liberation of the masses, you know. So really, it depends on your financial circumstances. You saw that young boy, Rick, who shot two persons during the George Floyd demonstration. In a matter of days, he had millions of dollars worth of legal defense funds, and he was subsequently acquitted. So it's really where the money is where you'll find justice. Otherwise, it seems to be a double standard in this country. And Donald Trump, when you brought up Donald Trump, now the judge that might be responsible for making sure he's extradited back to New York is someone that he put in office. So what do we expect from her? And, the big crimes is what people like Trump go ignored, and they're looking at this small crime, but it's better than nothing because help divide and tear this nation up, and it seems like he's not being held responsible for the coup d'etat that he helped organize to take over the U.S. government. That's just being overlooked, for example, and there are other crimes we could mention, but I won't take up your time preaching to the choir. And that's it. Thank you for allowing me to make a comment.
Thank you, Carlo. In closing out this discussion for today's program, I'd like each one of y'all to respond to this question of, it seems like there's a lot of aiding and abetting with crimes that are being committed by using the so-called institutional legal systems that have been set up in this particular society, in this government. There was the thought that if African people were getting these positions of power, they could use their brains, use their experiences, use their love for the people as a means to lessen the oppression against their community and their people. But there seems to be a disconnect. Yeah, African judges look like they're not using decisions, making wise decisions, just decisions, as relates to seeking out justice in general, and particularly justice for their underserved community and people. So in terms of when we're talking about these militarizations of the local police forces to having judges and prosecutors, particularly who comes from the African community, to act as an agent for the rich and the powerful, then really are we just participating in our own oppression? So I'd like to have each one of y'all final thoughts on this particular subject. This is the first part of a two-part series, Spy, Crimes, and Resistance. Brother Alex, 2 minutes, that's your final response to what you have heard and the two issues that we tied in this program today. So give us your final thoughts on them.
Okay, Mr. Lee, again, we touched on some subjects here today that we need to discuss. We need to talk about these things, you know, with our neighbors, with our community, you know, with our representatives. We need to organize, as was mentioned, and we need to do something about it because innocent men are still going to jail. We're weaponizing the police forces, and we do have even black police chiefs or black captains and different things that are, again, organizing different types of units that plague our own neighborhoods. I'm not even conscious of where they're getting these ideas from, that this is a better form of policing, terrorizing your own neighborhood. So it is so much going on as far as politicians are concerned, the same way as they take money out of black communities and continuously move them over into white areas and uplift them with better building and better housing and in our communities, no affordable housing and less jobs and less opportunities. You're bailing out banks and institutions, but you're allowing our black colleges to fail as their finances, you know, are in turmoil. So we have our priorities wrong as a nation to begin with, but then the priority was never on African Americans to begin with. So as Dr. King said, we were not even given the boots for us to be pulled up by bootstraps. So when you don't even have the boots on your feet, you know, how can you pull yourself up? So, I mean, it's just amazing, you know, what America stands for. And I turn the mic back over to listen to the other responses.
Thank you, Alex. Call 6029. Your family's your response to these phenomenal situations that we are addressing today. And even this question of, do we have to reassess this concept of the power of the vote? What are we voting for if we continue to operate in the capacity that was just displayed today as relates to the behavior of the judge out of Philadelphia and the Black Caucus, who have no problem of militarizing the local police force and allowing blank checks to be given to the state of Israel? You'll find the thoughts on those issues. Call the 6029.
You know, let me just be very, very succinct. You know, and you know, I'm assuming that, you know, certainly This is something that Malcolm X talked about many, many years ago. The problem, Brother Africa, is very, very simplistic. It is the question in terms of slave mentality. We have to be very honest with ourselves. To the extent that many of us have internalized a slave mentality, it doesn't only pertain just to the rank and file, but even to middle and upper middle income or even billionaire Africans. This slave mentality very much manifests itself in terms of what we do, how we do it, how we see the world. And as long as this mentality exists in our people, then the bottom line is it doesn't matter how much you vote, no matter who you send into politics, the bottom line, if they have a slave mentality, it's going to manifest itself on some level. So we think that voting is a panacea, that we think that somehow we vote that everything's going to be all right. Well, then today we refuted this notion in terms of that, you know, voting is a solution to our problems. Clearly, we have people in positions of power who are doing everything and anything to the detriment of the African community, and yet they're African people. Then it gives you pause for thought. You know, you got to reflect, and you got to say, wait a minute, well, hold it. As an African person living in society with presumably African children who have to navigate this society, a society that's very hostile to the very existence of African people, then given that reality, why would I innovate or endorse policies that are reprehensible, that are diametrically opposed to the interests of African people, me, myself, as an African person? So you ask yourself, what is that all about? Of course, you can rule it's all about class, and that's true. To some extent, it is class. But I think to a deeper level, I think it has to do with the slave mentality that exists in our people. And this is a struggle. So a struggle for all of us is to eradicate the slave mentality. I'm not going to lie to you and tell you that, listen, it never impacted me. Of course it did. I had a slave mentality before, so I'm not going to pretend like I didn't. As a matter of fact, the only women I would date were light-skinned women. You know, I saw them as better. So much more beautiful. I had that slave mentality. In that context, even though I didn't want to admit it at the time, I had a deep contempt for African people, even though I was African myself. So it's a process in terms of growing out of, and it takes a lot of work. First, you have to acknowledge that you got a slave mentality. Once you acknowledge you got a slave mentality, then the struggle is to educate yourself to remove away from that slave mentality. Because, you know, without the education, without the necessary reflection in terms of, you know, one's history, then refuting that slave mentality or rejecting that conditioning becomes extremely impossible, almost difficult, impossible to achieve. And so we got people in positions of power with that mentality. We have yet, in our 400 years of history here in this country, to adequately address the question of the slave mentality that exists in our people. We have our children who are internalizing the slave mentality. And it manifests itself in terms of what's going on in schools. Our young people are dropping out of schools. Our young people's perception is that, you know, intelligence is based upon skin color. This is the 21st century. Why the hell are we still thinking like that? To some extent, adults, and I put myself in that category, have failed the youth in terms of setting an adequate example and educating our children to make sure that we eradicate that slave mentality that exists in our people. So until we eradicate that slave mentality that exists in our people, the bottom line is that all we end up doing is sending representatives to Congress with a slave mentality who are going to do slave types of things, or certainly endorse slave type policies, and thinking that in doing so, thinking they're doing something monumental, that what they're doing is somehow an interest to African people. When in reality, they understand that what they're doing is no interest to African people. When you ensure the Pentagon, you know, budget is so large that even they don't know how much money they got, it doesn't do African people any good in terms of knowing that the Pentagon has access to all this money and then therefore use because they have so much money. Can simply provide free of charge weaponry to U.S. police officers, police agencies throughout the country. It does African people no good. When you support a Zionist regime of Israel and you spend sending $5 billion a year, that's just in terms of money to live off of, in addition to $3 million just in terms of military expenditures to make sure they have the latest military hardware. When you send sending $8 billion a year to this regime of Israel, to brutalize the Palestinian people, what the hell do you think if that's how they see the Palestinian people as an oppressed people, how the hell do you think they see African people in America as? We're also an oppressed people, whether we want to see it or not. I know many of us want to believe that we're Americans, and that's fine. You can have your delusion. You can have the delusion that you're an American. You know, as Malcolm X used to say, you know, you can bake a kitten, you know, but it still doesn't make him a biscuit. And we have yet to understand that given that the conditions that we're confronted with in society, if we don't organize fundamentally, if we don't create the conditions in our society in terms of excelling against all costs, then the bottom line that we succumb to the conditions that are created by the people in positions of power. And the conditions they create in a community doesn't bode well for African people. Whether we're talking about poorly funded schools, or whether we're talking about not having no access to jobs, or if we got one, being poorly paid, or if we're talking about lack of affordable housing, all of this stuff has a deleterious impact on the way we see the world. It certainly has a deleterious impact or negative impact in terms of how we see ourselves. If we don't create the conditions to refute that nonsense, that our essence is caught up in some kind of U.S. materialism, if we don't reject that premise, then we internalize all those things pertaining to what it is and what to the role of materialism in society. If we think material things define us as human beings, then of course, by the state or the system denying us those material things, then we see less of ourselves. If we don't fundamentally come to understand that that's rubbish, that things that define us as human beings, you know, then we succumb. We play by rules of the game because we think we are somehow blessed to be in America because the possibility of at least getting some things does exist. So this slave mentality that exists in our people has to be refuted. It has to be, and it's not an easy thing to say, but it has to be discussed. I know people don't like to hear it, but I don't care. Because my whole thing is that the situation in terms of the decline of capitalism in the society is very, very real. And the destruction of this system is inevitable. And here's the problem. Economically, when we talk about the fact that, you know, the decline of the dollar as a reserve currency, we got to understand one thing. As these countries around the world reject the dollar, it means that subsidizing the American economy will no longer be an option. When you do not subsidize the American economy in terms of you know, buying dollars, it means that the system is over. What does that mean for African people in society? We see the growing right wing in society of these racist groups organizing. We see these right wing politicians stating the most obvious in their bigotry. We see these billionaires funding all kind of policies to the detriment of African people. Against this backdrop, against this reality, it seems to me, you know, that if we don't fundamentally understand that we are somebody and that we have an inherent right to exist, then we accept whatever comes our way. My biggest fear in accepting that whatever comes your way without question is going to ultimately lead to our demise. I don't know what's going to happen in terms of the future of our people. Our young people Listen, most of us, we're going to be transitioned. We'll be gone. But at the point when it becomes extremely destructive, young people will have to deal with that. They got to figure a way in terms of negotiating or navigating this insanity that's coming their way. And to the extent that our young people are able to navigate around this insanity and organize and to build, it could determine to the extent that we survive in society. I know that's for some people that's sort of draconian. They say, oh, well, that's too much. But if you look at history, in terms of, you know, when societies fall, in terms of the repercussions of society falling, and the kind of death and mayhem that result from that, we cannot think for one second that somehow this information, this history is pertinent to the other parts of the world, but it can't happen in America. Yes, it can happen in America, and it's happening in America. When you look at statistically, when you look at an America where 100 African people die a month in the society, and the number is escalating, do you really think the number is going to decline? Particularly when you talk about the implementation of importation of weaponry, you know, very sophisticated weaponry coming from the federal government. So we got some problems with us. So to answer your question, brother, when you start talking about, you know, is voting the panacea that we hoped it would be? Of course not. But we have to come to a realization. But in coming to that realization, we have to understand that only is on African people to build institutions and the institutional organizations that we need in terms of our longevity in society. Only we can do that. We can't wait for other people to do that for us. If we wait for other people to do that for us, then we're in trouble. And my problem, my concern is that given that slave mentality exists in so many of us, I think we're going to essentially succumb to the conditions that be or the powers that be, and in terms of fitting and our desire to fit in, we're going to play ball. I think ultimately it's going to be, you know, be our downfall, and that's my concern, and that's why I'm adamant about, you know, speaking truthfully to these issues and not caring about what someone says, what someone feels. You know, I got to speak the reality based on how I understand the world, and hopes that some people see the legitimacy in the things that I'm saying, and make a course change in terms of trying to empower our communities to move forward in a very, very chaotic and a very hostile environment. I'll close with that, brother, but thank you for your time.
Thank you, caller, for your comments and participation. We go to our next caller, 4298. Your final thoughts on these issues. 4298.
Yes. I think, you know, I think the voting is not the panacea. I agree with that. But it is part of the solution, whether we like it or not. And that's reality. We're not just going to get leadership and control of the government by standing on the sidelines and commenting. Certainly, you know, there's a role for criticism and et cetera. But, you know, who's gonna run the city? Who's gonna run the city is the issue that we have to face. And, you know, that's just reality in my view. Thank you.
Thank you, Carl, as well, for your participation in today's program. And we'll go to Carl 7236. 7236, your final thoughts on these issues.
St. John's Wards and other things. Yes. Hello?
Yes, Carla, you have the mic. The mic is yours, Carla. Yes.
Yes, thank
you. Yes, Carla.
I'd like to say I agree with the other analysts that, one, voting is not the answer, but it is definitely needed. But more importantly, the previous person talked about what's going to happen, and with the upcoming generations, the militarization of the police is intended to marginalize and control the people. And Alex talked about affordable housing. Well, the issue isn't only affordable housing. The issue is affordability in our communities. Being able to sustain corner stores or grocery markets, being able to sustain daycare centers and these sort of things. Right now, as our culture advances and we see the decline of the dollar, we see in South Africa and the sub-Sahara, they're trying to organize and put together something they call the BRICS. We saw in El Salvador, they have already moved from the U.S. dollar, which was their currency, to this VIC, this new virtual money. So with the decline of the dollar, and the issue becomes affordability for housing, for commercial real estate, that we begin to see some kind of development in commercial real estate that would allow for there to be proper growth, like I said, daycare centers, health centers, you know, other things, environmental warehouses where we can recycle and upcycle and things like that. But that's not going to happen with the capitalists in charge, with this 1% making decisions for the 99%. And one of the unfortunate things in the United States, and I'll close with this, is that when the World Health Organization wants to discuss something with, about U.S. policy, they go to Bill. They went to Bill Gates. How could they go to Bill Gates? He's not an elected official. He doesn't represent the people by the vote. He's just a rich man in the United States. So we need to make sure that we not only put politics in command, but that we put the politics that that exists today, that, that Congress and the executive and the courts work for the masses. And we have to do that by whatever means necessary, demonstrations, organizing, pro bono teams of lawyers, getting big law firms, get involved in teaching young lawyers so that they can stand up for the civil rights of the people. Really getting back to reversing some of the laws that allow for the press to no longer be independent and speaking the truth. And so we need to reverse those laws that allow for this horrible opinionated press and get back to reporting facts and educating the masses. And we will begin to see change. And as someone says frequently, organizing is the key to all of this. So with that, I just want to say thank you for allowing me to speak. And we should all stand up against the militarization of the police. Thank you and good afternoon.
We thank you, caller. Good afternoon to you, to all our listening audience, our supporters. And this is the first part of a two-part series, Spy, Crimes, and Resistance. What we're going to do right now, we're going to take a station break. And when we come back, we will have Alex message to the community. There are some important announcements from MPH coming up, and we also can share with you how you can support this radio station. You listen to MPH Radio. This is the first day of April 2023, and we'll be right back after the station break.
When I was pregnant in jail, I thought I was going to have a baby and the baby would never be with me, but I was acquitted a month and 3 days before Tupac was born. I was real happy because I had a son.
When I was young, me and my mama had beef, 17 years old, kicked out on the street. Though back at the time, I never thought I'd see a face. Ain't a woman alive that could take my mama's place. Suspended from school, scared to go home. I was a fool with the big boys breaking all the rules. Had tears with my baby sister. Over the years we was poor than other little kids. And even though we had different daddies, the same drama when things went wrong, we blamed mama. I reminisce on the stress I caused. It was hugging on my mama from a jail cell. And who's thinking elementary? Hey, I see the penitentiary one day. Running from the police, that's right. Mama catch me, put a whoop into my backside. And even as a queen, mama, you always was a black queen, mama. I finally understand for a woman it ain't easy trying to raise a man. You always was committed, a poor single mother on welfare. Tell me how you did it, there's no way I can pay you back. But the plan is to show you that I understand. You all appreciate it.
Don't you know we love you,
dear mama. There ain't nobody tell us it was fair. No love for my daddy cause the coward wasn't there. He passed away and I didn't cry, cause my anger wouldn't let me feel for a stranger. They say I'm wrong and I'm heartless, but all along I was looking for a father, he was gone. I hung around with the thugs, and even though they showed a young brother love, I moved out, started really hanging. I needed money of my own, so I sang it. I ain't guilty, cause even though I said it feels good putting money in your mailbox, I love paying rent when the rent's due. I hope you got the diamond necklace that I sent to you,
Cause when I was low, you was there for me. You never left me alone because you cared for me. And I could see you coming home after work late. You're in the kitchen trying to fix us a hot plate. You're just working with the scraps you was given. And mama made miracles every Thanksgiving. But now the road got rough, you're alone. Trying to raise two bad kids on your own. And there's no way I can pay you back. But my plan is to show you that I understand. You all appreciate it.
Baby, don't you know we love you, sweetie?
And dear mama,
baby, please, no one above you.
You all appreciate it.
Baby, don't you know we love you?
Pour out some liquor and I reminisce. Cause through the drama I can always depend on my mama. And when it seems that I'm hopeless, you say the words that can get me back in focus. When I was sick as a little kid, to keep me happy, there's no limit to the things you did. And all my childhood memories are full of all the sweet things you did for me. And even though I act crazy, I gotta thank the Lord that you made me. There are no words that can express how I feel. You never kept a secret, always stayed real. And I appreciate how you raised me and all the extra love that you gave me. I wish I could take the pain away. If you can make it through the night, there's a brighter day. Everything will be alright if you hold on. It's a struggle every day, gotta roll on. And there's no way I can pay you back. But my plan is to show you that I understand. You all appreciate it.
Don't you know we love you, sweet.
Dear mama,
baby, place no one above you.
You all appreciate it. Dear mama, dear mama.
Stand up for your rights.
Stand up right now.
Get up, stand up.
That's right. We're going to get up and stand up for our rights, and we're definitely not going to give up the fight. Welcome back to the Voice of MPH Radio. This is the first day of April 2023. This is part one of a two-part series, Spies, Crime, and Resistance. At this point in time, we'd like to alert all of our supporters, allied friends, and the listening audience that on April the 12th, Missing Pages History will be doing their regional and seasonal television live talk shows. So on April the 12th, it can be viewed on Comcast, Channel 95, and on Verizon, Channel 65, in the Richmond metropolitan area of the state of Virginia. So in that region, if you're in the area, please tune in at 6 p.m., starting on every Wednesday at April the 12th, in that area of the Richmond metro area. Check us out. While at the same time, if you'd like to become a supporter, friend of MPH Radio, you can do that by emailing us at mphradio@yahoo.com, and we'll share with you how you can support and help us build this institution. Also, we want to alert everyone and let them know that this program is a community-based program of MPH, or Missing Pages of History, Inc., which is a nonprofit 501c nonprofit organization. It seeks to build our underserved communities through communication and working collectively with the people. We need your help. We need your support. So please come and join us. So at this point in time, we can close out our program with a message to the community with Brother Alex, and we'd like to say on all of our programs, the views that you may hear express are totally the views of the individuals and not necessarily the views and opinions of the station nor any of its members or affiliates. So at this point in time, Brother Alex, we're going to bring you back in. We want you to share with us what is your message for this program to our underserved communities. Brother Alex, the mic is yours.
Well, again, Mr. Lee, I appreciate, you know, the show and all the callers have called in. And we've learned a lot today, and we found out that there's a lot that we need to discuss and need to talk about, because these are community issues that not only will last our generations, but the next generations. So we need to stick together as a community and come together as a bonded force to make the changes needed in not only our lives, but in this country's life. So I would like to say that over the past months, many in the world have been watching to see if justice will prevail in the court cases of numerous African Americans who have been beaten or shot to death by the police all over America. It has been a pandemic of hate. This vicious rise in hatred of African Americans is deeply seated in many European Americans who were led to believe by a former ex-president that even when an African American is exonerated of a crime, he is still guilty of something and deserves to be executed. Spending over $85,000 in ads with the New York Times, the Post, the Daily News, the New York Newsday, and others in May of 1989, his hate filled the front pages about five black youths who were innocent of the crime, but his influence was a key in their conviction. He proclaimed, "Bring back the death penalty, bring back the police," in bold letters on those front pages. He argued that politicians were overly concerned with the public outcry about police brutality, such as the fatal shooting of a disabled black woman by a New York police department. Department officer in the mid-1980s, to the point that they weren't letting the neighborhood cops do his job of protecting the community, creating a reckless and dangerous, permissive atmosphere which allows criminals of every age to beat and rape a helpless woman. He said, these muggers and murderers should be forced to suffer, and when they kill, they should be executed for their crimes. This former, disgraced ex-president has never apologized for his lies or misproofs spoken about these innocent men who spent up to 13 years in jail for a crime they did not commit. Though the state of New York has set them free and paid them millions of dollars, the former president still spreads more lies about them being guilty of something. They are now responsible citizens, and one is seeking an elected office. There were lawsuits of racial discrimination and housing and employment against Trump and his father in the late 1970s that made New York City front page news. This is when he started his constant ridicule of blacks and minorities in music, military, education, legal, and the government arena. It is so fittingly to see the bigoted ex-president be arraigned for some of the many crimes he has committed. It is even more fitting that on the day that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated, he should go to the same jail and courthouse where he personally tried to end the lives of the innocent Central Park Five. So, the side of our king, the rock of our salvation, let us enter his presence with thanksgiving. Let us make a joyful noise to him in song. For the Lord is a great God, a great king above all gods. In his hands are the depths of the earth, and the mountain peaks belong to him. Moravian Standard Bible. And if he should die, take his body and cut it into little stars. He will make the face of heaven so fine that all the world will be in love with the night. Shakespeare, Romeo and Juliet. These are the words from the eulogy given by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. for resident James Joseph Reb, a white minister who was attacked, beaten, and killed on the streets of Selma in 1965, realizing then his own death may be near. The sound of thunder and heavy rain break the silence of the lone one in room 306 of the Lorraine Hotel in Memphis, Tennessee. Dr. King, called by many Doc, had spoken to his beautiful and faithful wife, Greta, earlier that he would be home. He heard the kids playing in the background, and that made Doc feel all right. He had laid down early because he had a bad cold, maybe even the flu. Doc was worn down and tired. He was feeling worse than he had in a long time. So tonight, he decided to rest. He was too weak to stand or speak. So he must let Abernathy do it tonight. Just when he found peace and his eyes became heavy with sleep, the phone rang. It rang again. And it seemed that it wouldn't stop ringing. Ralph's voice on the other end was in a panic. The crowd had braved the storm, and they wanted to hear from their leader. They wanted to hear from a king, and he better deliver them one tonight. Doc was so moved that he dressed and came to the Bishop Charles Mason Temple as the storm raged all about. He would give his last known speech to his people and the world. We treasure it today, as he titled it, I've Been to the Mountaintop. The speech was a masterpiece of grave intent about the state, the affairs of the Negro, and since he was kidnapped and bondage arrival in America. The Negro's personal dilemma with law enforcement and justice itself had to change. And innocence must prevail in many cases. He spoke that he was happy to be alive, to see the Negro progress from when Negroes were just going around scratching where they didn't itch and laughing when they were not tickled. But that day was over. We mean business now, and we are determined to gain our rightful place in God's world. The issue is injustice. He spoke of the homeless and the hungry. He spoke of his love for the poor as his Poor People's March was being played. Then he began to list the victories of the civil rights movement had brought about as many were beaten and assaulted to bring America to a social conscience it had never had before. Then he quoted his nonviolent stance about Negroes having respect and decency for all others. Words could do more damage than sticks and stones, as it were words that imprison the Negro in America. Using the right to vote to change and make laws that favor the Negro and his social standing in America. Then he talked about the threats against him and the attacks on his life, as in 1958, a demented woman almost ended his life by a stab wound to his neck. Had he only sneezed, he would not have been able to do God's will for his people. He spoke directly to his people as the lightning flashed and thunder roared outside the temple. His final passage may have prophesied his death the next day. Well, I don't know what will happen now. We got some difficult days ahead, but it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop, and I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I have looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. And so I am happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. Then Doc collapsed the next morning, feeling somewhat refreshed. Doc walks out onto the balcony to chat with friends and his colleagues, joking over planned dinner at Reverend Billy Cow, as Doc was hungry and happy. Then Jesse Jackson introduces a Memphis musician from below. Oh, yes, Doc calls down. He's my man. How are you, Ben? Make sure you play Precious Lord, Take My Hand in the meeting tonight. Then a shot rings out. The bullet finds its mark. Doc falls. The king's life is now history. He has joined his God forever. We cannot change what happened, but we must retell the true story of his life, so there is no doubt in his legacy. King gave his life so others could enjoy the fruits of God's blessings to man. We are in the image and likeness of God, but we do not share his love or compassion. King gave us a blueprint that we could easily follow. First, we must learn to love each other or perish as fools. And I'd like to thank you, family, for giving me this opportunity. Thank you, Mr. Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Allen Jordan, for your message to the community and to our listening audience again. Our next program will be on African Freedom Day, April 15, 1958. Yes, we'll be on April the 15th at 1 p.m., same time, same station. Spread the word. Come and join us. And for those who just would like to make a financial contribution to support us, you can do that by just simply sending in a check or money order to Missing Pages of History, Inc., P.O. Box 27782, Richmond, Virginia, 23261, or you can Zelle it to, in all small caps, Missing Pages of History 1 at Yahoo. That's right. You can mail it to Missing Pages of History 1 at Yahoo.com. All spelled together. Until next time, we remind you, check out our upcoming live TV program on April the 12th at 6 p.m. on Comcast 95 over Verizon 65 in the Richmond Metropolitan area. It covers one city and about five counties: Richmond, Hiraco, New Kent, Gooseland, Hanover. So join us. So until next time, let's remember to always strive to go forward, backwards never, and continue down the road of filling in our missing pages of history. This has been the voice of MPH Radio, and remember, we will always be here for you. We thank you for allowing us come to your homes this evening. And we're looking forward to seeing you on the 15th of April, MPH Radio.
Let's do more. Control the sound of soul, shooting rockets.